wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. It is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this September 18th Monday. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. How do we begin to think about the inner demons that afflict us, like guilt, self-loathing, and free-floating anxiety? Well, Clayton Morgridge's new book, Demystifying Demons, Rethinking Who and What We Are, inquires into the nature of the human soul, how it is put together, and why so much of it is hidden from consciousness. His book revises our conception of ourselves so that our demons no longer seem to come from nowhere, but have intelligible explanations. And Clayton is here this morning to read from his new book, and we have 5 copies available as gifts when you call in during the Old Mole this morning to become a member or to renew your membership. So think about doing that this hour. We'll talk to you more about becoming a member of KBOO and Clayton's book later in the program. Bill Resnick talks with Jessica Tovar, an organizer for Local Clean Energy Alliance of California. She grew up in East Los Angeles and worked for decades for environmental justice in a variety of urban, rural, and indigenous communities. Today, Bill and Jessica discuss the community organizing that was necessary to persuade the Alameda County Board of Supervisors to support and enact the East Bay Community Energy Program discussed in Part 1. Category 4 hurricanes, Harvey and Irma, left a trail of destruction within 2 weeks of each other. In both cases, it's obvious how the priorities of capitalism made these natural disasters so much worse. But what can be done about it? Tom Becker reads an edited version of a speech by Paul Fleckenstein entitled Climate Chaos and the Capitalist System. This was a talk given at a meeting of the International Socialist Organization chapter at University of Vermont. And we'll begin now with Clayton Morgridge reading from his book, Demystifying Demons. Clayton?
Thank you, Denise. Well, a central theme of the book, and which is actually political, is to insist that we human beings are deeply social beings, meaning not just that we have to cooperate with each other in order to make our livings and to avoid conflict, but that social life makes up the very foundation of our souls, of who we essentially are. Of course, social life is also a problem and a source of our inner demons, like guilt, for example. So a lot of self-help books propose to separate the soul from its social connections that cause those problems, and even from the body and its pains. In this section from Chapter 1, I examine this idea of the soul or the self as existing apart from the material and social world that is so prevalent in self-help books. Self-help books, of which there are thousands, often with the word soul in their titles, promise a quick and easy path to enlightenment and an end to the troubles of our souls. This book, as already mentioned, is not a self-help book. It may help, but it offers no guarantees and makes no promises. The path we will follow here is a more difficult one, with more questions and fewer answers than self-help books. To explain why this more winding and ambiguous path is worth taking, I would like to show why the promises made by self-help books are deceptive and likely to give only short-term and unreliable relief. One of the more intelligent and well-written self-help books is The Untethered Soul, The Journey Beyond Yourself by Michael A. Singer. His book and mine begin with the same problem, expressed in different words. While I call attention to our inner demons, like guilt, self-loathing, and anxiety, Singer points to the voices we hear in our heads giving us unwanted advice and criticism. Both books pursue the question, who am I? But pursuing this question takes up most of the rest of my book, and the answers are tentative and incomplete. Singer, on the other hand, leads the reader quickly to a definitive answer that, he claims, provides the key to enlightenment and the silencing of the inner voices. Here is how he proceeds. He presses the reader to answer the question, who are you? But he refuses any response that refers to your relations with others, and anything about your body and anything that you have done or that you are experiencing. All of that, he says, can and does change, while you remain the same you. Everything that goes on in your mind, your feelings, emotions, and your thoughts are just objects you are observing. They are not parts of the essential you. So what is left to be you? Simply the pure consciousness that is doing the observing. This pure, unencumbered, untethered self is free to choose to have or not to have fears or desires towards whatever passes before it. Since nothing that is in your mind is really you, there is no need to go on defending all that extraneous material you used to identify with. Quoting, "The reward for not protecting your psyche is liberation. You are free to walk through this world without a problem on your mind." Unquote. Moreover, there is no danger that you might be troubled by demons you cannot see or control, for nothing within us is hidden from the enlightened and fearless consciousness. Quoting again, "Because there is no part of you that you're not willing to see, the mind is no longer divided into the conscious and the subconscious." Unquote. Well, this reduction of the soul to a pure act of consciousness is an attempt reminiscent of the philosopher Descartes to remove us from the real human condition of flesh and blood bodies, desiring the help, companionship, and love of others, and who depend on the soil and weather of the earth for comfort and survival. Singer, like many others writing in this vein, seduces us into picturing ourselves abstractly, secure in an imaginary existence apart from anything in the world that can cause pain and suffering, including our own desires. The pure self we are asked to suppose that we are is nothing. It's an immaterial, solipsistic non-entity with no qualities and no motives for acting one way or another. The idea that this pure, disengaged consciousness is us, our souls, has no relationship to what we know of our lives in a material, biological, chemical, and social world. It gets its confirmation only in the fleeting experience of readers who succumb to a fantasy of total freedom from anything beyond their control and feel momentarily empowered by a baseless self-confidence. The possibility that we are conscious of only a very small part of our souls and that our inner demons may be grounded in parts of ourselves beyond our grasp can never be taken seriously once pure consciousness is defined as the totality of what we are. Let us take ourselves as we really are. The difficulties and obscurities that arise when we try to answer the question, "Who am I?" point to something deeper than consciousness, and it will take a careful inquiry to get even a rough idea of who and what we really are. I do not claim that it's impossible to fundamentally change our mental and emotional habits by means of proactive, intentional action, whether by some spiritual practice like meditation, resolving to replace negative thoughts with positive ones, or following a 12-step recovery program. But many people begin such practices only to give them up after a few days, weeks, or months. Why is this? As we will see, every word we utter, every gesture and posture of the body interacts with a fabric of feeling and expectation, fear and desire that was woven into us before we had any ability to perceive or control ourselves. Trying to give conscious direction to our souls is rather like trying to use wrenches and screwdrivers to manage the flow of water in an ancient swamp. Some people do come to feel more in charge of themselves, less controlled by alien forces, when they deliberately decide to think and act differently under the guidance of someone who tells them what to do. But I think the odds of success and the ability to sustain such changes will be improved by the sounder grasp of how our souls are put together that is offered in these pages. We are going to try to make sense of ourselves and our lives. If nothing else, I hope you will come away from this book with a deep appreciation of the awesome complexity of the human soul. I'm Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Coming up next, we have Jessica Tovar. Jessica is an environmental justice activist working in California. This morning, they talk about the struggle to actually enact the East Bay Community Energy Program and all of the variables that were at play during that time.
Hi, Jessica Tovar. Welcome to KABU.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Jessica Tovar is an organizer for the local Clean Energy Alliance of California. She grew up in East Los Angeles, worked for a decade as an environmental justice and climate justice organizer in a variety of urban, rural, and indigenous communities throughout California and Arizona. She now is with the local Clean Energy Alliance in California. Jessica has been there for close to 3 years. Over the past 10 years, they've had enormous success. And the success is that the people of Oakland and Berkeley and Richmond and Hayward and several other cities in Alameda County, its people will soon be getting their electricity not from PG&E, that's the former private investor-owned utility. Now, PG&E is a California utility. PGE in Portland, Oregon, where we're doing this interview, is a completely separate company. The people of Oakland and the other cities are going to be getting their electricity not from PG&E, but from what's called the East Bay Community Energy Agency. That agency will be contracting with sun and wind power producers of many kinds, we'll hear about that during the interview, to buy clean solar and wind and other forms of clean energy. And those customers are going to be paying less than they paid for electricity than before to PG&E, and there are many other benefits. Congratulations, Jessica Tovar. Tell us how it all happened. There's been a great struggle over the last 10, 15 years.
Sure. So like you mentioned, I'm a community organizer with the local Clean Energy Alliance, and that's very important because to really galvanize community, you need people who are really focused in making connections with the various community people, stakeholders, and really educating them and involving them in deciding what those solutions can be in their community through a program like this. So we really see Community Choice Energy as an opportunity to get community benefits and really address solutions around energy in our community through Community Choice Energy. So that's pretty much been the role of my job at the local Clean Energy Alliance, is really making connections with environmental justice, climate justice community, the social justice community, the workforce development groups in the community, housing groups, and of course, the unions in the community.
And individuals, right, in churches and schools.
Sure, all kinds of people.
You're out there. Tell us about Community Choice Energy. That was a California program that was enacted when? In something like 2004?
2002, Assembly Bill 117. And that was a long time ago that policy was enacted. And I believe the first Community Choice Energy program took off in 2010, so there was a lot of time in between when that was passed.
Yeah. Was that in Marin County, or was that Lancaster? There were a number
of... Yeah, it was the Marin County program, exactly.
Uh-huh. And now there's a bunch of them. In fact, almost all counties, than the big ones in California, except for L.A. County, which has a public utility already.
There is a part of Los Angeles County that is actually working on community choice, and they're the ones that are not included in that.
All the big cities of California are now working on community choice aggregation, which is really taking over the electricity supply network. Tell us about Alameda and the struggle that you've been in to get the County Board of Supervisors to get engaged in the community energy program.
So our initial struggle was actually finding an entity, a city, to take on Community Choice Energy, and there were some attempts to getting the East Bay MUD to take it on, City of Oakland. And finally, it was Alameda County Board of Supervisors that said they were going to consider Community Choice Energy program and would do a feasibility study. That's pretty much when I came on working with the local Clean Energy Alliance to really bring together a countywide alliance of different stakeholders and people interested in Community Choice Energy to really advocate the county to really make this commitment to starting a program, but really focusing on getting a commitment that over time they would commit to actually building local clean energy infrastructure, as well as having a governance piece within the program where community can engage and exercise their energy democracy.
And when you say you're building out the program in the county, tell us what you mean by that. The Clean Energy Agency in Alameda County could just buy power from producers in New York State or South Dakota or from huge wind or sun plantations in Arizona or New Mexico.
Right.
That's one way of doing it, and they probably could also make that energy cheaper because they're buying renewable energy is just getting so much cheaper than any kind of fossil fuels or nuclear or any of the other alternatives. They could still be cheaper, but in Alameda County, you've been organizing in particular, right, for local build-out. Tell us what that is.
Sure. We see community choice energy as an opportunity to really transform our communities. We're very critical of the fact that the programs actually start off solely, sometimes even about just buying and selling energy. And what we actually want to see is that over time, this program will invest the money it makes into actual local clean energy projects, wind, solar projects that could be owned and run by the community, within the community, so that we can see and actually have jobs created in that sector for the community, because we can get so much more benefits through a community choice energy program that actually invests locally in that local build out versus just buying and selling energy off the market, because that energy comes from far away and it's money that goes out of the community. And if you actually build local wind, local solar, then you have your money generating in the community and being invested in the community. And overall, that is a huge benefit to the community.
Yeah. That's one of your major selling points.
Sure.
There are a bunch of other selling points, I think, that we've talked about this earlier, and I would like to make that point, particularly because in Oregon, we have nothing like community choice aggregation. There's a few small projects. We don't even have net metering. The big utilities basically dominate the legislatures and the city councils. They're powerful in the state, and they're basically uncontrolled and dominant in energy supply and distribution. In California, it's a completely different story. And Oregon, of course, is supposedly clean and green. This is KABU Radio, 90.7 FM, Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Jessica Tovar, who is a organizer for the Local Clean Energy Alliance of California, who helps groups in every county, and almost every county now is doing it, is to basically take over the energy supply and not just contract with big sun solar plantations and big wind turbine farms around the country and in California. In Alameda County, they're building out in Alameda County and creating Alameda County jobs. But there's a lot of other benefits. Let's talk about them. First, you talk about it being cheaper. Part of that, I think, is because you're just using the existing grid. Is that right? PG&E will still be running the grid, but they're going to have to invest to smarten up the grid. But that's so much cheaper than PG&E building a huge, highly secure, environmental-destroying grid, because it's wires, and they have to make sure those wires are safe, and they have to make sure that's redundant and reliable. It's tremendously expensive. It's like building superhighways. But in Alameda County, you don't have any of those costs.
Well, one thing to make note of is that all community choice programs, when they start off, they are buying energy off of the market, so it is energy from far away, which is why we really pushed the county supervisors to commit to doing a local clean energy build-out development over time, so the building of solar and wind projects within the community. Community choice energy does offer affordable rates in comparison to PG&E or whatever the investor-owned utility is. But if we're actually having local wind and solar, we're actually, because when you think about, there's a lot of cost, right, in the transmission of energy that comes from far away or out in the desert, for example. And if we're actually producing locally and using locally, then we're omitting some of that transmission. So we do see that also as a benefit of having local clean energy. A lot of other benefits you would get, you know, are obviously boosting the local economy, and actually seeing your money circulate locally is really important. One of the things that we address is that when you pay that investor-owned utility or PG&E, that money's gone. That money goes into shareholders. But Community Choice Energy is a non-for-profit local agency, and so you can actually begin to invest the money that you start making into local projects. And so that's one of the things that we are really pushing for. And we did get a commitment from the county to do a local development business plan, and that business plan is really checking in with all the different stakeholders in the community of what kind of benefits they would like to see locally. And just to be clear, this East Bay Community Energy Program is the first of its kind that has committed to local clean energy build-out and committed to having community in its governance structure. So those things were really key, and that's really what we've been working to organize for. And so it's really important that we have a community choice energy that creates solutions in the community and addresses everyone's need, and not just buy and sell energy off the market. And it's not just about the different cities reducing their greenhouse gases, but how this could actually benefit everybody, because we do see that as a huge benefit, right, by curbing climate change is important, but in order to actually really address all communities and all the various stakeholders, we have to look at this more holistically and how it benefits everyone.
Let's just talk about the build-out locally. Alameda County will soon, you're pushing for it, it's a lot of it is still to be implemented, but it certainly is going to be in the next year. Everybody's committed. But there's going to be a net metering program of some kind. That is, if and small businesses want to put up on their roofs or small parking lots or in garages, put up solar panels or maybe very small, fairly silent wind turbines, people will in fact be reimbursed for the excess electricity that they feed into the system. And that's really important, because what you're going to see is springing up of solar panels and solar installations. When you're putting up solar panels, you're saying, I want to be part of the solution to climate change as well as community development. It seems to me quite wonderful what you're doing.
Yeah, we're definitely in a phase, because we're shooting for a spring and summer launch in 2018. So we're definitely in a phase where we get to define the details of the various benefits within the program. And so one of them is, as you say, net metering, or I would say the benefits to people who install rooftop solar, be it a home or a business, and what kind of benefits, credits, or actual money they can make from putting solar on the roofs and generating and reselling that excess solar into the community. So that's just one of various benefits that we've identified. We've also talked about how to create like a fund, for example, for low-income people who might be behind on paying their bill, and actually create a fund to ensure that the lights don't go out because they're behind on their bill, for example. So really thinking about, well, how can we uplift the various people in our community, because the East Bay is very, very diverse, right? You do have more affluent communities and people in Berkeley, for example, but you also have a lot of low-income people in Oakland and other parts of the East Bay. So we're really trying to think about, well, what are other benefits besides incentivizing rooftop solar? What are the other things that we can do for renters, for example? Can we do more shared solar projects, for example, where a whole community invests into this shared solar project and they reap the benefit of getting solar energy, but it's not necessarily on their roof because either they can't afford to put it on their roof or they don't own their roof, right? So we're trying to think about the various ways this program can incentivize all people. So that's really what we've been bringing a lot of stakeholders together to talk about and think through about, well, what can we do to make sure everybody can benefit from clean energy.
Next up we have Tom Becker, longtime Old Mole. He is going to read a piece by Paul Fleckenstein. It was a speech given to the International Socialist Organization recently called Climate Chaos and the Capitalist System. Tom?
Thank you, Denise. Paul Fleckenstein is the Co-op Efficiency Program Manager at Energy Co-op of Vermont. In a recent speech at a meeting of the International Socialist Organization chapter at the University of Vermont, Fleckenstein blamed the horrific flooding in Texas and Florida not just on global warming bringing more rain, but also on other aspects of unregulated capitalism's hunger for immediate profit at any cost. The speech is entitled Climate Chaos and the Capitalist System. We all witnessed two catastrophic storm events in the past 2 weeks, Fleckenstein begins, but the weather catastrophe that got the least attention in the U.S. was the extreme rainfall in South Asia over the last several weeks as a result of the worst monsoons in decades. One-third of Bangladesh is underwater, and there are over 1,400 reported deaths in Nepal, India, and Bangladesh. And this is just the beginning. Millions face a long-term crisis of hunger and lack of access to drinkable water. In the U.S., Hurricane Harvey produced record rainfall in Houston, 50 inches, caused more than 60 deaths, flooded 100,000 homes, and forced hundreds of thousands of people to flee. To understand and learn from this crisis in Houston, we need to begin with the fact that Houston is a prime example of capitalism in the 21st century. It's a city like others built around extreme wealth disparities, with immigrants, people of color, and the working class as a whole often relegated to the most environmentally dangerous areas. It has its own cancer alley along the Houston Ship Channel, which was, of course, swamped by Harvey. The area is home to oil refineries owned by all the giant energy firms, from ExxonMobil, Shell, and Marathon on down. Houston was the global capital of the oil industry in the 20th century and is still that today, which means its elite had an outsized responsibility for global warming. A city without zoning, Houston has been left to real estate capital as a super profit center. Because of the unrestricted development, wetlands and prairie that provide natural storm buffers are paved over with impermeable surfaces. Quick profits were made from building in low-lying areas. Houston had an estimated 600,000 undocumented workers running key sectors of the city's economy before Harvey, and immigrant labor will be critical to rebuilding. Yet Texas's anti-immigration law, SB 4, which deputizes state, county, city, and campus law enforcement officers as immigration agents, was supposed to kick in during the middle of the disaster, scaring many immigrants away from seeking aid. Even for capitalists, there's a carelessness about the making of Houston that is remarkable. One-third of U.S. oil refining capacity was shut down during the Harvey crisis, and half of all capacity is located in this region that is vulnerable to storm. The physics of severe weather today is pretty simple. A warmer atmosphere holds more water and more energy, providing the fuel for bigger and more intense storms. More severe storms are a certainty as a result of man-made climate change. And the trend of superstorms, extreme heat events and droughts, of extreme weather events in general, is going in the wrong direction, toward greater instability and extremes. Harvey, therefore, gives us a sobering glimpse of the future. Naomi Klein is right that now is the time to talk about climate change, and after Harvey and Houston, is necessarily a time to talk about capitalism. I want to sketch out a basic Marxist understanding of the capitalist roots of the climate crisis. For everyone dedicated to fighting against climate change, Marxism is a great starting point, beginning with the contributions of Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels in the 19th century. As Marx observed, quote, "Man lives on nature, means that nature is his body, with which he must maintain in a continuous interchange if he is not to die. That man's physical and spiritual life is linked to nature means simply that nature is linked to itself, for man is a part of nature." End quote. Marx and Engels noted that this unity with nature is ripped apart by capitalism through a metabolic rift, a separation that deepened and further developed under capitalism, where a small minority of the population controls all major aspects of the economy. Capitalists are driven by competition to single-mindedly seek more profits. The free market imposes the drive to accumulate on individual capitalists, which results in a focus on short-term gains that ignores long-term effects of production. As Engels wrote, quote, as long as the individual manufacturer or merchant sells a manufactured or purchased commodity with the usual coveted profit, he is satisfied and does not concern himself with what afterwards becomes of the commodity and its purchasers, end quote. For Marx, the alternative to capitalism's destructive system was democratically planned economy. Socialism, by which he meant the associated producers rationally regulating their interchange with nature, bringing it under their common control instead of being ruled by it as by the blind forces of nature, and achieving this with the least expenditure of energy and under conditions most favorable to and worthy of their human nature. End quote. Capitalism is driven by the perpetual need to produce more profit, or it snowballs into recession and crisis. So it isn't just enough for scientists to develop new technologies that could create a sustainable world. They have to be put to use. And under capitalism, they won't be unless it's profitable to do so. If we need a radical reorganization of society, then environmentalists must set their sights not just on changes within the capitalist system, but ultimately on the abolition of the system itself. To avoid ecological catastrophe, we need a society based not on competition and undirected growth, but on cooperation, economic democracy, and long-term sustainability. Marx offers a compelling vision of such a society in the final pages of his three-volume work, Capital. Quote, even an entire society, a nation, or all simultaneously existing societies taken together are not owners of the earth. They are simply its possessors, its beneficiaries, and have to bequeath it in an improved state to succeeding generations, end quote. Anyone who thinks we need system change needs to be dedicated to all the struggles for change today and to arm themselves with the contributions of Marxism towards understanding the roots of the crisis and the alternative to it. Our struggle for socialism is literally a struggle for the future of the planet. That was from a speech by Paul Feckenstein entitled Climate Chaos and the Capitalist System. The full speech can be found on the socialistworkers.org web magazine page.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. We're concluding our program this morning. It is a collective labor that brings you the Old Mole every Monday morning at 9 a.m. And I want to thank first our Old Mole Collective. We have been around for quite a long time, maybe getting close to 25 years now. Bill Resnick started the program as the Old Mole Show back many, many years ago, and it was a half-hour program and has evolved into this hour-long variety hour. So Bill Resnick, Jan Hawken, Desiree Helligers, Joe Clement, our engineer today, Patricia Kohlberg, Clayton Morgridge, Norm Diamond, Larry Bolden, Laurie Mercier, Fran Michelle, Mike Snedeker, Tom Becker, and myself, Denise Morris. We've all been members of the collective. We have our past members and still sometimes contributors, Johanna Brenner, Catherine Sammy, and Brooke Jacobson. Just wanting to thank them for their long service to the Old Mole and for also being great mentors to me as a young person coming into radio and into politics way back in the 80s. But here we are in 2017 and still going strong, as is KBOO. So thanks for everyone's support. Thank you. This is Denise Morris, and thanks to Patricia Kohlberg, our engineer this morning.